time in the last six seasons, the Dutch are the champions.
This is Gary O'Neill to win it.
They've got it! Terrific header, Callum Robinson, super ball in.
Great feeling, we have to treasure these nights.
Well, hello there. Welcome along to the RTE Soccer Podcast. Delighted to say James O'Toole is with us, albeit remotely. And James, from what I gather, you're covered in dust these days because you've been delving into the RTE football archives. What have you been up to?
Yeah, we've been looking back through some of the great qualifying games the Irish team have gone through over the years. Starts in early May, I think it is. We go live on RTE 1 and 2, I think. But we start with Ireland versus Russia from way back when. I think it was 74, maybe, in Dalymount Park. Yeah. Liam Brady's first game for Ireland. Absolutely brilliant. Big flowing locks he had on him, but he looked so small, but so nippy, and just getting around guys looked really, really good. His display looked absolutely brilliant.
And of course, that was a memorable day as well, because Don Givens got that famous hat-trick.
Yeah, Givens gets the hat-trick, and what a way to get it, in fairness. The crowd in Dalymount is absolutely amazing. It's jammers. It's crazy. And Jimmy McGee says at the end, he speaks about how it's brought life back into Irish football and gives Givens a really, really big pat on the back for his display and the whole team's display, in fairness.
Okay, all part of the RTE Gold series, looking back at some great sporting moments over the decades, including Gaelic football and hurling and rugby and what have you. Other games to look forward to in terms of football, James, what else have you been digging your teeth into?
We have the France game as well from Lansdowne Road, if you remember, the 3-2 victory over France. They've got a 2-0 victory over Croatia at the start of the Euro 2000 qualifiers. Who scores in that? Roy Keane scores in that one. Dinny Irwin puts in a great display during that game as well. We also have Ireland versus Germany. That goal from Shane Long, if you remember it, in the new Lansdowne Road in Aviva Stadium to give Ireland a 1-0 win. Great goal, great direct play, absolutely fantastic memories of them games.
Okay, and of course the football coverage in terms of those screenings in May and June. Now, coming up, Stephen Kenny continues to shake things up as Republic of Ireland manager. Rory Higgins poised to leave Dundalk for analysis role with the Irish setup. And of course, we remember Galway United's great day in 1991 when they lifted the FAI Cup at Lansdowne Road. But first, the league here remains on hold due to the COVID-19 pandemic. June 19th is the scheduled date for a return to football. We have with us Ollie Cahill, PFA Ireland player executive, and also the chairman of Drogheda United, Conor Hoey. Chaps, many thanks for joining us. Conor, the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, speaking at the weekend, says he believes it's highly unlikely we're going to see mass gatherings this year. Do you think that statement, is that the death knell for the 2020 football season?
Well, you try to remain optimistic and hope that maybe there'll be some form of vaccine or cure or something that will enable mass gatherings to happen a bit quicker. But, you know, all we can do as football clubs is take the advice from the authorities and from the government. We were hoping, I mean, that's probably best intentions, hoping for September, but I'm planning for the worst case scenario, which is next February.
And why next February in terms of being, as you see it, the worst case scenario?
Well, I just think, you know, if you get to the stage where, you know, we're almost going to be writing this year off possibly, and then, you know, we'd be starting a new league next February. I mean, it's a dreadful situation to contemplate, but You always have to plan for the worst in these situations. Anything that happens before that is a bonus. I mean, look, like every other person in Irish football, I want to see football tomorrow. But equally, you know, if you plan for the worst and you've a club still standing and viable come next February, that's good news. But, I mean, I hope I'm wrong. That's all I can say. I mean, I hope we can get going sooner than that.
Ollie, what's your take on the situation? Obviously, you're in touch with the players a lot, but how would you read it at the moment? I know it's difficult because events change all the time, and we're talking possibly about easing some restrictions in a couple of weeks' time. But then, obviously, Minister Harris comes out with what he said at the weekend, and that's a gloomy prospect the way he outlined it, isn't it?
Yeah, it does make it gloomy, all right. I think we've been in touch with the players, and I think we've had a few answers on the back of Minister Harris' comments yesterday. Because I think they were looking at possibly maybe a return to some kind of training, not now, but like say come May the 5th or maybe a couple of weeks after that, that some of the restrictions might be lifted and they might be able to get back training in small groups in a controlled environment, and with possibly looking at, obviously still looking at June 19th, but look, if that doesn't happen, that it might be a few weeks after that, or like obviously not talking about the February scenario that Conor mentioned there. So, you know, on one hand, they're optimistic about maybe getting back into training and getting some kind of normality back, but then Minister Harris comes out with that statement. So that is bleak. But again, look, you've got to be optimistic. Like if June the 19th isn't the runner, is there dates in between, say, rather than just writing off the season and looking at next February? And I suppose during the week as well, that we published a survey which 63 of our players took part in, and it was some worrying stats out of that, because coming out of it that players are, some players are suffering from showing moderate to severe anxiety symptoms and depression symptoms, and 62% of them are concerned about their future. And so this is all, obviously, it's a precarious situation that the players find them in year on year anyway, with one-year deals, and you know how the contract runs out in the season and they don't get paid then for 2 or 3 months, and looking to the next season. So for a season to be written off would be a disaster for them.
Okay, you brought up that FIFA Pro survey. You might just expand on it. Tell us a little bit more of the findings. I know they have to be officially published just yet, but you have the results as far as professional footballers in Ireland are concerned, the 63 that you mentioned.
Yeah, obviously the FIFA Pro have undertook a survey, and they're covering as many countries across Europe as they can, and they're going to publish an overall general result from that, I think maybe this week or possibly next week. But we got the breakdown from the Irish players, and say 63 of our professional players took part, and it was only like a snapshot obviously of the players playing the league. But what it does say is that there's players out there are suffering and worried and need help. And I suppose from our end, our job is to try and get them the help they needed. If they're like 19% of players showing moderate to severe signs of depression, 14% showing moderate to severe signs of anxiety, so like that's worrying. But say from our end, we're just trying to get it out to our members and the players that like that there is help there, and we have services in place that can help the players and the. Not to leave, there's the one thing, guys, filling out these anonymous surveys, it's great that we get the feedback from that, but then the next step for these guys is to actually come forward and say, look, I need the help, I'm struggling to get my head around this, or I don't know what's going to happen in my future, and I'm worried I have a family or this or that, like, and say we've got structures in place that can help these guys. And again, look, a return to training and a return to playing would have to leave a lot of the suffering that the players are going through. But as we're saying, like, who knows when that's going to be.
And Ollie, quick one for you, are the players entitled to the furlough payment, the €350 payment? Are they entitled to that, and have many of them had to apply for it already?
Yeah, they would be. Look, lots of the, I suppose, the first division players would be part-time, and there's not too many professionals in the first division. A lot of them are amateur. But as I said, the part-time players, a lot of them are working. Some are obviously still in the job, which is great. If they have no income from the football, and if they're the other job that they're working part-time as well, if they've got let go or temporarily laid off due to that, obviously they can claim the payments. The players in the Premier Division, then, if there's any of the full-time players or like they can claim that €350, and obviously that the top up that scheme that the government have come out with as well, that 70%, and then clubs can top up their 30% up to a maximum. I think it's €410, so they're eligible for that. I think the furlough scheme which you were mentioning there, that's the UK and all, but I think the Derry, I think, should be entitled to that as well. There's different parameters obviously around that and different regs for them up there, but I think the guys down here to say all the full time lads anyway would be entitled to claim that.
And Conor, what's the situation at Drogheda? Because Drogheda as a club, and you as a chairman, you're amongst the first clubs to act once the delay came in terms of the league. You went at it pretty much straight away in terms of laying off players. So what's the scenario at Drogheda these days?
Yeah, well, we did, because we could see the writing on the wall, to be honest with you, you know. And every penny saved helps the club in the longer term to survive, you know. So, you know, our players have been great, both our amateur and, you know, the players on professional contracts have been all really great and understanding. And, you know, it really, I look at it as a deferral, you know. I mean, if we got the season going again, as Ollie said, maybe if we did get it going, you know, whether it was going to be June or whatever it may be, you know, the players would still earn what they were expecting to earn over a season. So it was really a deferral. And I think a lot of clubs are in the same boat. But, you know, of course, the shorter the season becomes and, you know, the uncertainty that goes forward, that gets more difficult. But as a club, you know, we know what our outgoings are, and we've minimized those right down to the bone. So, you know, I can see in the horror scenario of not being able to play for a number of months, I can, you know, I can at least know what my costs are going to be, and I know there's going to be a club at the end of it. And, you know, as a guardian of the club, like every other person who runs League of Ireland clubs, you know, my job is to make sure that the football club here, and, you know, we're lucky, I have to be honest, that we, you know, even if we had been promoted last year and we were now in the Premier, I'd probably have a lot more players on bigger contracts, and I'd have bigger overheads and all the rest of it. So actually being in the First Division, you're able to manage things a bit easier, if I'm being frank. You know what I mean? It's tougher when you've got a bigger organisation, a bigger commercial operation. But, you know, even for us, you know, we've got lots of outstanding sponsorship monies. You know, I have significant cash that I'm owed, really, from sponsors. And, you know, I'm not going to go out and hammer sponsors for money now when small businesses who support clubs like us are struggling as well. So, you know, that's money I've got to go out and try and chase once we get going again. And, of course, we're entering a very different economic environment. So I'm probably going to lose some of that. So, you know, every club is having to take a step back and look at what is the operating environment economically that we're going to have to live in post-COVID.
And given that you're involved in football and overseeing Drogheda United, and you suggested there that perhaps you're a little luckier than other clubs, but when you look at the Premier Division and clubs that are full-time, or, you know, a mixture of part-time and full-time, would you be worried for some of those clubs as the situation evolves?
Look, I think a number of clubs have been brilliant in terms of standing by their players. You know, I just think Bohemians is an example. I think that they've been so well managed as a club, just picking them in particular, in recent years. You know, they've been able to, you know, financially they can afford that. But of course, it's like with any business, you know, there's a limit on how far you can go with that. So, you know, it before it really starts to bite. So the only thing I would think, I mean, you know, we're spending a lot of time thinking about this, and I'm on the working group of the future of the league, which we're going to get going again this week. You'd wonder whether every, you know, those clubs which are full time can remain full time post COVID. And again, it is purely just comes back to what I said about sponsorship. It's the simple stuff. If you're trying to raise money in a town of 40 or 50,000 people, when suddenly the unemployment rate's gone up, people have less money, you know, sponsors have less money, you know, can full-time clubs operate in that environment going forward? So I'd be, you know, I think every club is probably going to have to review all of its financials and its operating models going forward. But, you know, just on a more positive note, you know, I know it's a difficult time for everybody, but it is time for us to take stock for the future of the league. And to really take a step back and think about tactically where we want this league to go on a 1, 3, 5, 10-year basis, and what should be our priorities in terms of the structure of the league, you know, one or two divisions, winter, summer football, the impact of youth football on us and, you know, running some of the underage teams, you know, artificial pitches, investment in infrastructure, tactical investment in stadia. You know, I'll just give you one example. You know, Drogheda, you know, God, Ollie will even remember this back when he played for us, you know, trying to get a new stadium. And, you know, I'm still trying to do that, but I have to face up to the realities that in the future, as I say, in a post-COVID, you know, sort of retrenched economic environment, I'm more unlikely now to get 5 million or 6 million quid from the government to help build a new stadium, and I'm going to get less money for the sale of United Park. So I've got to hunker down and think, you know what, the likelihood is I'm going to be in United Park for 5 more years. And what do I do to improve United Park for everybody in that 5 years? Do I, you know, put in new showers for the players, new dressing rooms? Do I, improve the toilets. That's a bugbear in many League of Ireland grounds. Do I put in an artificial pitch so that we can train in United Park and save money? So, again, every club has to take a step back and look at it. But also, it's time for everybody, from common journalists to former players to existing players to all the clubs, to sit back and go, hang on, how can this league function better going forward in terms of, as I say, structure is the big thing for me. The All-Ireland League is still something I think we can even look at now as well.
Ollie, do you want to take up some of the points made there by Conor, who's chairman of Drogheda United? He did mention that post-COVID, and hopefully that comes pretty soon, but that maybe the full-time model that so many clubs employ may not be the way of the future. How would you respond to that suggestion?
Difficult to say. Obviously, look, this is going to hit every club. I suppose when you see a club, the Shamrock Rovers, and what the players have done there with taking the cut as well, that says it all. But that's not to say that...
I presume you were involved as that decision was being made in terms of the players' perspective, because the players came out afterwards and Ronan Finn was quoting some of the papers talking about how the players were aware of the situation and the financial crisis facing the club in terms of no money coming in, so that they felt it was the onus was on them to make a statement of sorts, and in taking the pay cut they've stepped up to the mark. But you were aware of that situation as the players were discussing it, were you?
You would have been aware, because we have delegates at every club, and we have regular meetings with all the delegates just to keep them up to speed on what's happening and for us to get feedback from each of the players as to the situation at various clubs. And look, every club is different. Like Conor came out there and said about Bowes, what they did, which is fantastic. But that doesn't suit every club, so it's not a one-size-fits-all here is going to work. And again, I think the next step is in the full-time thing may not be a runner. I think, again, that's up to each individual club, once they get out of this, to review that and have a look at where they're at. I think clubs had made huge strides. Again, say, look where Bowes are, where Shamrock Rovers are, Dundalk, the way they've run and been run the last number of years. And I suppose the disappointing thing, obviously, is, look, economically, where everyone will be hit from this. I think the new regime that I came in, I think they have a genuine passion and interest in the League of Ireland, and we're trying to push that to the forefront. And we were hoping a few months ago that there'd be financial investment into it and pushed into it, and that we'd be able to build and grow the game, and say the All-Ireland League and the possible talk about that, or restructuring the league here. Hopefully this it might set it back, but hopefully, as I said, there's a working group put together to look at structures going forward, that we can still push this on, we can still try and improve and build on what we have at the moment, and say with the people that are in the FEI now, that they're passionate and they care about it and are trying to do everything to push that forward with the help of the clubs and everyone else, that we can get this up and running and better than it ever was before.
Well, that has to be the hope, of course, Ollie, but as Conor mentioned, so many businesses at the moment are feeling the squeeze. Money is going to be tight. It's going to be difficult to implement the kind of plans that the FEI might well have had in December, January, post-COVID, because the money may not be there.
No, I'm not saying it is going to be difficult, but I suppose I feel like, say, I was at Drogheda, I was at Shelburne when they were on their knees previously. Look at where Dundalk were previously, where Shamrock Rovers have been a number of years ago, that they've built it back up slowly. They've got there, but to where they are now. So I said, doesn't mean to say, I'm not saying it's going to be easy and we're just going to play one. It is going to be very difficult. Economically, things have changed. Every club is going to have to look at where they get money and how they operate. I think every business is probably looking at it now, how they can do things differently on the back of this, what's happened. So I'm not saying they're just going to kick on. It might be a case of, here we are now, we've had to go back to here. Connor's just saying there, it might be in United Park for another 5 years before they can look at maybe a new stadium or something. But again, not to just say, oh, we're back here, that's it. Let's try and look. Let's see where we are after this, and can we build it again? Can we just move it on? Can we keep going? I'm saying it might be a few more little steps rather than the big steps that we were looking at previously, but let's try and aim to get there and push it in the right direction anyway.
And Ollie, speaking about pushing in the right direction, as Conor already mentioned, this could, if we go to February, be ground zero for the League of Ireland. So if you take the FEI situation into place where they're starting a new clean sheet again, clean slate again, it could actually be an opportunity for the League of Ireland to sit down and think of its future, as Conor mentioned, like for 5-10 years down the line.
Yeah, well, they have put a working group together. This working group was kind of put together during the summer of last year, when there was talks around the All-Ireland League and the Quinn Consortium, and they get presentations and stuff. But it's kind of, I don't know what happened, but this working group now is back up and running. So I say they're going to look at structures going forward. So I think at the moment you wouldn't be ruling anything out or in. Like, everything is on the table, and saying now is a chance, say, for everyone to sit back, take stock, review again, and go, what can we do? Where, as I say, once we come out with this, where are we? FAI as well, obviously financially, the troubles that they've gone through, all the issues they've had. Will Gary Owens, who's going to be in situ, who's going to be permanently there going forward? Will they have the passion for the League of Ireland? Can we drive this on? And come February, whatever, if we've finished the season, if we've managed to finish this season and got through it, we've got through it. It was tough. It's not going to be easy. It will be tough. Right, we've got through that. Right, here we go again. What are we going to do? I say, how are we going to improve things? And say that things that might have been looked at for next year, the year after, might have to be pushed back a little bit, but let's not sit back on our laurels and go, right, we've got through that. Let's just mosey on. Let's try and kick it on. Let's try and push it on. And say, hopefully, from the top, from the FAI, that the guys are in there that can keep driving it, keep pushing it, clubs pushing it together. So players get on board, and we're all in this together, and we can try and put something out there that we are proud of. Obviously, people that are in the game for years, we've been in the game for years, we are immensely proud of it and passionate for what we've got. And I think the game in this country got to where it was due to the hard work of a lot of people on the ground. I say the FAI at the time, the people running it, it looked like they didn't give it the care and attention it needed. But now let's do that. Let's start again. Let's go for it and see where we can take this.
And Ollie, I'm on this working group that we had last year that looked at all the structures. And look, you know, Gary Owens and Niall are, you know, big advocates of, you know, challenging everything in the league at the moment and really making sure that we have a viable league and product going forward. But, you know, I think there's a lot of goodwill towards the league from all of our supporters. Everybody is dying to see football again. You know, I feel that if we could open our stadium tomorrow, we'd all be packed out with people who just want to see sport and want to support their local club. That's not necessarily practical right now. But if we get it right, we have a chance to recapture the public imagination with the League of Ireland. And that's why we need to use the next few weeks and months to get input from as many people as possible with as many creative solutions around the league. So that, and as I say, even if it is us relaunching as an All-Ireland League, for example. I mean, that's just one idea. And you know, is this the chance? You know, sometimes out of a crisis, you know, you can sometimes create something brilliant. And this could be a chance for us to do that. So we have to approach it in a positive mindset that actually this could be, as you say, a ground zero for the League of Ireland and actually the chance to relaunch the league. But in a realistic way, you know, as I think as Ollie mentioned, you know, we have to look at where do we want to get in 5 or 10 years. We're not going to build it in 6 months. But if we set the right roadmap for everybody and we all agree that we're going in the right direction on it, I think we can do something. But, you know, let's be really innovative about it, is my view. We have to do something a bit different.
Conor, you're being very positive there, which is very encouraging, and one needs positivity in the world that we currently live in. But when the league meets and when this group that you're involved in meets, what's going to be top of the agenda? Because whilst it's all well and good to be talking about, you know, starting afresh and looking at football and the bigger picture and 5 years down the line and possibly an All-Ireland League, right now the pressing concern for most people involved in the league is probably survival, surely.
It is, and it's to get back playing football. I mean, all of our players, God, as Ollie will know, and it was really interesting hearing what Ollie had to say about the mental health issues and everything earlier. These guys live for football. They want to be back playing football. I know the same from all of our players at Drogheda. All they want to do is get back playing football. So we have a short-term issue, obviously, in that regard. But you know what? None of us are going to make that decision. That decision is going to be government-driven. And we will do it in conjunction with whether it's the FAI, UEFA, government, etc.
working together to do that. So there's external factors there, which are just going to dictate the short-term solutions. But, you know, we have to use the next couple of months to really think about when we do come back. And, you know, as Ollie said, that, you know, there might be a, you know, a short-term season, let's say this year, if we got through that. And then, but, you know, for example, you know, should we turn around and say, look, you know, we think we can get back in, I don't know, October. So let's play a winter league for 1 year. No, actually for 5 months as an experiment to see whether the public are interested in it or whether actually it brings new crowds. Let's play on Saturday afternoons, right? I'm just throwing stuff out there now. I'm not saying any of these are viable, right? But just to think a little bit differently for that, maybe for a window when we can do something a bit different to see whether it captures the public imagination, or do a 5 month All Ireland League. You know, and these things might not be feasible, but remember that the league in the north is almost finished and the league in the south has barely started. So we're almost both at this situation where, you know, neither of us have got a solution going forward. So we're both almost at the same point. So do we use that to say, you know, now is an appropriate time for us to come together to think about something different? Now, again, these things I'm throwing out there, it's just me being stuck here at home thinking of this stuff, yakking away on the phone to people I know in the game and all the rest of it. But it's important now to use this time to think about that. And that's where the views of whether it's you guys or Ollie or players, coaches, former managers, whatever it is, to start to thinking, like, can we do something a bit different now? Because we can't come back with the same product, is my view. You know, the league needs change.
Ollie?
Yeah, definitely. I'd agree. I'm just thinking that people might be a bit more wary now of travelling. So you might have people who would have gone over and back to England, Scotland, or whatever, watching games, might think twice about it. Now there's an opportunity to try and get some more people in the gate to the domestic football here. Said people are probably crying out for some kind of football and something to watch now. So, you know, there's an opportunity there. But yeah, look, I'd agree with Conor. I think it would need change. I've seen the presentations from an All-Ireland League, I'd say, and that's the way to go. It was exciting. It was very different. It was, you know, I think anyone that was at any of those presentations from Cairn Lucid would have got excited about it. Obviously, there's a lot for the clubs to take on board and see if it's viable for them. But it was exciting. But I think on the back, the upshot from that as well was there was discussion around the league here and how can we improve and how can we make it better. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the working group he's on is looking at the league and the structure and the future going forward, not about probably the now and how to get through this COVID-19 and how we're going to get out the other side of that. I think the National League Executive Committee and the clubs themselves are kind of looking at that, but this working group is looking at the structure and the future and how they can make it better or what's the route to go down. So I say, yeah, let's it'd be hard for a change and something new and something fresh and see if it works.
Okay, well, listen, we leave it there for now. Just to go back to Conor before we wrap this element of the podcast up, I know it's very difficult, Conor, but you did sort of raise the possibility that we may not have football this year. You spoke about the worst case scenario being February of 2021. What's your best guess at this stage as we sit here in April?
Oh, blimey. You know, when I saw on the front of the paper this morning that, you know, pubs in the UK are going to be shut till, you know, the end of this year. And now I'm not sure if that was going to be true or not, but, you know, it gives you an indication of the direction of travel. You know, Germany's not having any sporting events until the end of August. And even then, with spectators, you know. I tell you, my biggest worry is trying to find what I call interim solutions that actually won't work for clubs. They have to work for every club. So I'll just give you an example. If somebody said, okay, we're going to go down the live streaming route. Now, that's a great idea for 1 week. And let's say we get, you know, we'd all be paying a few quid to go and watch whoever it was, Pats against Rovers or against Cork, whatever. That'd be great. But you know what? It has to work for every club in both divisions. We're all in this together. We need promotion and relegation to make the leagues work. So, you know, even the idea of some form of social distancing somebody mentioned to me this morning, said, just let season ticket holders into the grounds. And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, that means I've no gate revenue. And the gate revenue helps me to pay the bills and doing the halftime raffle and selling a few jerseys and, you know, the few bob that you make around the game that help things to tick along. That, you know, I just don't see how that works when you just have season ticket holders in and the gates are down significantly because of social distancing. So, you know, when I want us to come back, and I said it to Drogheda, the United fans said, when we have our first game back, it's free in, right? Because I want to celebrate football being back properly. And I hate the thought of having to look around United Park and see 200 people wearing masks and that's it. That worries me because I don't know how I'm going to pay the wages of the lads on the pitch if I don't, because you know, how do I get the sponsors to pay me when there's 200 people in a ground, you know?
And given what you're saying, playing football with no fans behind closed doors, given what you're saying, is a non-runner.
Oh, no, it's an absolute runner if somebody stumps up a load of cash to subsidise it.
Yeah, yeah.
If UEFA give the FAI the money to subsidise clubs, all of us, every club, to compensate us for the fact that that's how we have to work, then we'll do it. And that's great because that gets the players back. And I want to come back to Ollie's starting point about mental health. You know, that's one of the top things that we're thinking about at the moment is looking after the lads, the players, the guys in the club. So if that helps to solve that problem, brilliant. I'm all for it.
And Ollie, just to finish on that point that Conor makes, I guess the door is always open at the PFA offices. If players are feeling, you know, under pressure at the moment, because it's a very difficult time for everybody, but for footballers in particular who you represent, I guess just pick up the phone is the message, is it?
Yes, absolutely. So we're always at the end of the phone. We're pushing this. Throughout our club visits before the season started, we got around to nearly all the clubs and before the season kicked off, and we push it then. I say we have regular meetings with our delegates, weekly meetings, and we're onto some of them daily and telling them to go back to their various squads to say, look, if anyone has any issues around anything at all or just needs to chat to someone or anything at all, to pick the phone up to us. Say we've private and confidential services available for any guys who are struggling mentally and I need professional help in that area. And say we're always on the end of a phone. And I keep saying, like, the players just want to play. They live to play football. And when that's taken away from them, it's not like a lot of other jobs. Like, it's like you said, this is their life and blood, and they love it, and they are itching to get back into it. But of course, you got to put the health and safety of them and everyone else around to the foremost. But I say when football is taken away from lots of guys, struggle to cope and say without even training or any sort of routine, it is difficult for them. So I say, yeah, anyone that's struggling at all, just give us a call and we're here to help them.
Okay, fair play. That's Ollie Cahill, PFA Ireland player executive, and we're also chatting with the Drogheda chairman Conor Hoey. James, very, very much tough times for everybody involved in football at the moment.
Yeah, it's very tough. And you listen to two guys who are obviously at the cold face of it, one looking after a club and one trying to do his best for the players in the league. It can be a little bit disheartening and kind of take any kind of oomph you have out of you when you realise how desperate the situation is. I'm just wondering, I think, was it Denmark announced yesterday about drive-through matches where could pull up in their cars in the car parks and watch them and stuff like that, which would then turn obviously Daily Mount Park into the ideal position and knocking down half the Connacht stand as a genius move. But I don't know how you get back into that. Like, I don't know how we get it back again. And as well as that, with the Simon Harris thing about talking about mass amounts of people beside each other, I don't know if he's talking about the League of Ireland, to tell you the truth there. I think he's probably talking more about your Aviva Stadium full, your Crow Park full, etc. I don't know if there will be limits put
but
on
is
it.
Is there a difference, James?
Let's take the positives out of it. There is a massive difference, obviously. So we may get football back.
Well, just
we
in terms of numbers, but if you're talking about any kind of mass gatherings.
Yeah, it depends on what their limit is on it. Like, there was limits they put in before lockdown was put in place, if you remember. It went from 1,000 to 500. So it depends on... Like, they're going to take, obviously, the advice they're given by the professionals, and people will have to listen to that. But, you know, we'll wait and see. We'll keep positive views on it. And hopefully, I would suggest the earliest we're going to get, if we get to see football in this country live, is going to be mid to late July at the earliest.
I think that's rather optimistic, but there you go. Anyway, we'll press on as Stephen Kenny continuing to plan and formulate his backroom team as Ireland manager. Another imminent addition to the setup, Rory Higgins, who is poised to take on a role as analyst for the Republic of Ireland. He's been Vinnie Perth's assistant at Dundalk for the last week. While we're joined on the line now by Dundalk-based journalist James Rogers. James, Dundalk a little bit irked by the manner of the approach to Rory Higgins. He hasn't signed on the dotted line just yet, but why are Dundalk feeling put out at the moment by all of this?
Well, I suppose it's the way it was handled. Maybe, you know, there's probably still a few sore wounds there from the Kenny departure as well. Like, bear in mind, he was probably the club's biggest asset at the time, and he left for nothing in the end, despite being under contract until the end of this year, actually, end of 2020. I mean, there's a clear rule there from the FAI in their own rule books to say that clubs should be contacted in writing before entering negotiations with a professional. Now, that probably more deals with club to club, but I mean, this is effectively twice now in less than 2 years where it's happened, where key members of the Dundalk backroom team have been approached in a manner that Dundalk don't feel is, you know, befitting of the rules. I mean, that rule says there should be, you know, any breach of it is subject to appropriate sanctions, and, you know, in many ways, it's the organisation that's meant to, you know, put those sanctions in place that are doing it. So it's a bit of an awkward one. I think most people wish Rory Higgins well in the role. He'd be well respected. But I think it was just the manner in which it was done. I believe that the first that the club knew about it was a call to say he was basically on his way, effectively. So, you know, it just maybe could have been handled a little better.
And again, Dundalk as a club unlikely or will not receive compensation for Rory's departure.
Well, I believe they are looking for it on this occasion. I mean, there's a technicality regarding Kenny that the FAI didn't have to pay at that stage, but Rory is in contract till the end of the season, and I suppose, like anything, if you're in a contract, I mean, you can't have it both ways. I suppose in many ways, while people in this area would be delighted to see Stephen in charge, it was technically his contract that got him in there, because otherwise they might have said, well, you know, we'll stay with Mick McCarthy for the time being. So you can't have it sort of both ways. You can't say, well, you know, contracts have to be honoured on one side and then disregard them in another when, you know, to suit yourself. I'd imagine Dundalk will get some form of compensation. And I'd say that's probably the reason why it hasn't been officially announced by now. That is going on in the background, I'd imagine.
And James, obviously, you had this up in your Twitter account the beginning of last week, I think it was, talking about Rory moving on from Dundalk. But it sounds a bit strange. Do you know who Stephen had doing his match analysis for the under-21s? And it seems a bit strange that if he had someone for that, he wouldn't bring that person on, or was Rory doing that as well?
I'm not 100% sure who was doing it exactly. It could be a case of that, you know, that person is staying on with Jim Crawford and his team, and maybe he doesn't want to rattle that. Maybe he, and without knowing the person, I don't want to belittle him, but maybe he ranks Rory higher. I mean, he did enjoy, obviously, good success with Rory there for a few years, and particularly when you're scouting opposition in Europe and that, because it probably does involve, you know, maybe a lot more travel, whereas maybe Stephen had the time to look at things a bit closer, you know, in his under 21 role, because he did go to a lot of matches, and obviously things like the Toulon tournament, you're able to go to other matches probably a bit easier while you're over there. But I'm not sure who was doing it for his 21s, but certainly he rates Rory very highly. I spoke to him before last year's FAI Cup final, and, you know, he always said Rory would make a great coach, and he liked his eye for the game, and obviously he was someone he really respected both as a player and then afterwards. So I suppose he was someone he probably knew he could trust, and you know, I suppose you have to rate these people, you know, when you're not there to look at games yourself, you have to really appreciate what this person is seeing, and that, you know, it'll fit into what you want. And I suppose because they've had that prior working relationship, Rory will know what Stephen wants, and Stephen will know that what Rory has given him is fairly accurate in terms of what he wants to get in terms of answers on how different opponents are playing and different setups and stuff like that.
And James, you're obviously very close to the scene in Dundalk. We were talking there a few moments ago about clubs throughout the length and breadth of the country and League of Ireland football and the prospects of football returning at some point. We had Conor Hoey suggesting the worst case scenario is next February, so that would mean that the 2020 season is a wipeout. In terms of Dundalk, because people tend to look at the likes of Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers, and we know that Shamrock Rovers players have taken a pay cut of 25%. Is there a pinch point that you're aware of perhaps looming for Dundalk in terms of keeping the show on the road? Because obviously the longer this goes on, no money coming in, everybody's going to feel a pinch point.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. I mean, they've given a commitment that, you know, all contracts will be honoured, both on and off the field, and certainly that's been the case so far. I get, like, the longer it goes on, I mean, if we've no football till next February, that becomes that bit more difficult, but in many ways, I think, you know, there is money in the bank, and I know that can easily be, you know, burned through very quickly. But also, it's been a good show of support from Peak Six. You know, they're a $1 billion company, and they've given this commitment. And, you know, I think both locally and nationally, there's probably been question marks over that commitment for some time, because we've a past experience in the league of maybe investors coming in and promising one thing and maybe not following it up. So, you know, I think so far so good. They've shown, you know, a real commitment by you know, the easier thing would have been to say, well, we're going to impose a pay cut or something like that. But you know, they've kept on, and from what I gathered, they're willing to back the club going forward as well in terms of transfer markets. And obviously now probably a new assistant will be needed as well. So as far as I'm aware, they haven't looked at that. But obviously, as the situation goes on, that may or not change.
Okay, well, listen, we leave it there. James Rogers from Dundalk, Dundalk-based journalist. Many thanks for joining us on the RTE Soccer Podcast. Now, it was one of the great days in the history of Galway football. The 1991 FAI Cup decider, Galway United 1, Shamrock Rovers 0. A special day for Galway captain Johnny Glynn, who got the only goal of the game 4 minutes from time.
Right side of the Rovers penalty, good ball in, it's in the net! Yeah, Johnny Glynn, the Galway captain, surely. That'll take the cup to Galway. They've gone wild. The Galway supporters are tumbling down over that terrace in behind the Rovers goal to our right. Lovely, lovely play, snappy play from Galway. The 1-2, Tommy Kane, the little man, the ball player, in the penalty, whipped across in, and John Glynn, the big man, in like a flash. With a finish, he's done it into the lap of honour behind that goal to our right. And Galway are only, what, 3.5 minutes or less away from winning cup for the first time in their history.
Well, there you go. What a moment for all connected with Galway United. We'll be chatting to Peter Carpenter, who is part of the starting 11 on the day, very shortly. But Johnny Glynn is on the line. Captain on the day, and you score the winner a few minutes to go. Dream stuff, John.
Hi there, yeah. Absolutely. Thank you very much for bringing up those great memories for myself and everybody, Galway United and everybody involved in Galway football.
It must have been a life-changing day for you, was it?
Yeah, was it life-changing? It was, of course. I was, as a young fella, I was a big Galway United supporter. Went to every game from when I was probably 12 or 13 on a Sunday afternoon. We used to cycle, and Peter Carpenter as well, actually. We'd cycle to Terryland from probably the club started in the league in 1977. I probably started to support them in 1979, as I said, on Sunday afternoons. And then I signed for the club in 1984 and made my debut that year. And after a spell in America, I came back to the club in 1989, actually. And then, of course, 1991. We had that fantastic year with Joey Malone, came down as manager, and, you know, everybody dreams about scoring a winning goal in a cup final, and I was so lucky to have that opportunity.
And what a cross from Tommy Keane, the late Tommy Keane, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago. Terrific ball, and you arrived right on cue. And a terrific celebration, because it was a lovely goal, but you fairly hurdled the advertising hoarding before celebrating.
Yeah, I mean, so many people now who tell me they were at the game and that it was a great header. Of course, it was my right foot that I scored with, but it was so long ago now, people's memories get a bit mixed up. But yeah, Tommy Kane, I mean, did all the hard work. Well, actually, Derek Rogers claims to have made the goal, because he must have knocked the ball wide and the Shamrock Rovers keeper kicked it out. So that was the start of the move. So Derek Rogers reckoned he had a part in the goal as well. But Tommy Kane went down the right wing and put a fantastic cross in. And it's probably something we had been working at in training with Joey Malone and Adrian Walsh, our coach, about those late runs to the near post. I arrived at the right time, and Tommy pulled back a fantastic ball from the corner flag, and I arrived at the near post, hit my right foot, and went in. And I didn't know what to do, really. I hadn't. I'd always planned, I suppose. You dream about scoring the winning goal, but you don't dream about what you do afterwards. So when I encountered the hoarding behind the goal, I just went over it. And then when I looked back at the video, poor Tommy couldn't get over the hoarding, so he had to go around to catch up with me. That was fantastic.
Well, Peter Carpenter is on the line. Peter, how do you look back on that day, a day of great celebration to win the cup? And as was mentioned there in commentary by Gabriel Egan at the time, Galway's first FAI Cup success. It must have been very, very special for you and for everybody, especially being a Galway man as well, because it was a team with a very, very strong Galway flavour to it.
Yeah, it was. Joey Malone had been very clever bringing in the guys that he brought in, the John Cleary, Larry Wise, Paul Campbell, Soupy, and blended them nicely. And he saw what he had here in the West and produced a nice combination and gave us confidence. You spoke there about, or Johnny spoke there about the celebration, jumping the hoarding at the far end. It was too far for me for a start. It was too far for me. And I turned to Jimmy and I looked back at John Kerry and I knew he was gone as well. I thought, I ain't a notion of going there. So we kind of waited around and I knew if we could win the ball back as soon as they touched off, okay, we'd be chance here. But as for that celebration clearing the hoarding, I'd say if he tried it again 10 times, he wouldn't make it. As for poor Tommy, he did the right thing too.
John, it was a very strong Shamrock Rovers side that you were facing on the day. The likes of John Devine, who'd been capped by the Republic of Ireland. Of course, up front, fairly fearsome twosome in Vinnie Arkins and Derek Swan. Derek Tracy was also in that team. So it was a formidable Shamrock Rovers side that you were taking on, but both sides went at it on the day.
Yeah, it was a very strong side. And as you mentioned, the front two, and we had John Cleary and Derek Rogers, and that was a very formidable centre-half pairing that we had as well. If you look at, suppose, at the history of Irish football at that time, and, Rovers had won the four in a row, 87 was their last year, and they still had a really, really strong squad. Galway United historically had won nothing, got to a cup final in 85, which I was lucky to have played in, and actually a number of us, Noel Myrna, Jimmy Nolan, Kevin Cassidy, Stephen Lally, and the great Eamon Deasy. So you had all those, six of us had also been involved in 1985. Now, Peter Carpenter was still in short pants at that stage, but, so we had lost to Rovers in 85, and going into the game, I suppose, we were underdogs, and with no real history behind the club, not having won anything before, it was a very significant day for Galway United.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact as well, as Johnny mentioned there, Peter, so many of you knew each other. You were neighbours.
Yeah, we all grew up together. We all grew up together as a club here in Galway called West United. They always produced good players, so like the Eamon Deasy, Tommy Cain, Noel Mernon, Stephen Lally. Johnny said I was in short. I was actually in England at the time in 84, 85. I come back in 86, 87. And the quality of the players here at Galway, I've been in England for maybe a year, year and a half. You're Letizia's, Shearer's coming through. But we, Tommy Cain, you had guys like Noel Myrna, Engine Room, box to box before. We had good quality in the West of Ireland, but you had a guy called Eamon Deasy. He would have given us confidence. He had done it all. He played in Europe. He'd won the 1981, wasn't it? The Villa, 13 men winning the first division at the time. He gave us all the confidence, quietly in the background, and quiet word before the games as they were coming along, quarters, semis, didn't get heavily involved, but he was just the sounding board that you could talk to, and he put you straight and right. So there was, the quality was there. I know on the day going up, I can't mention names, but there was a wee bet. I don't know, can we say that legally? We were 5-1 to win that game. Now, there was half the bus that was on it, and as Johnny would say there, I think every supporter claims that they were on it as well at the time. But in each position, we were fairly confident, and we were fairly capable of looking after ourselves on the day. We were pretty strong on the left and pretty strong on the right and down the middle. Joey was always quietly confident, thinking, yeah, you know, we'd be okay. I know I spoke with him a few years ago about things, picking the team and what was he thinking. And he had been in touch with Noel King at the time, and he was saying quite confidently to Noel, for weeks beforehand, we're going to beat you, we're going to beat you. Now, Noel's biggest regret, I think, he says that he didn't play himself. He reckons if he played himself, now that would be Kinger. If he played himself, it would have been different. But Joey had been given Noel a bit of a stick beforehand, so listen, we're going to beat you guys. He was so right when you think of it.
Yeah, Johnny, going back, you were speaking there about, obviously, several of you guys lost in 85 in Dalymount to Rovers. So you went into it and said 5-1 was the odds. But you fairly gave them a fair rattling in the first half in that game. Like, you were the better team in the first half, and Rovers came back into it a bit in the second half. But overall, you well deserved the win.
Yeah, we didn't lack confidence, and that's probably, I will put that down to Joey Malone, the manager, did a fantastic job throughout the year. We didn't have a great year in the league. I think we finished fourth from bottom, actually. But our cup campaign went really well. Now, I missed a couple of the first two rounds against Cove and Shelburne due to injury, but with each round of the cup, so as I mentioned, Cove and Shelburne, and the quarter final was against Limerick, but we were gaining a lot of confidence. But throughout that season, Joey had instilled a lot of confidence in the team. You know, our goalkeeper Declan McIntyre needs to get a mention as well. He was an excellent goalkeeper, and Johnny Morris Burke. We had a lot of character in the team. As I said, that character with the added confidence that we got and the experience that we had in the squad, also that on the day going up, we didn't feel inferior. We didn't feel that. We felt we had a great chance to win the game.
And the celebrations, Peter, what were they like?
Well, for the next many years or just the next few days? Look, I think it sinks in over the years. You kind of look back now. I hope it happens again soon and very soon for United. But when you look back at the time, take it a year or two later, there was more players to come in from Galway that started to believe. And I mean, Ricky Flaherty wasn't in that squad. Jerry Mullen wasn't in that squad. John Brennan did very well for us when he came in a year or two later. Now, those players would get into many of the team, but if you put them with that squad on that day in 1991, I'd hate to be the manager picking the team. There was a lot of quality here in the west of Ireland, and it goes back to Joey Malone visualising it and tapping into it and getting the right mixture. Going back to confidence, as Johnny says there, without being overconfident and cocky, yeah, no problem. We were okay on the day, and that's not a problem. We were quite confident. So celebrations-wise, we still meet up every now and again, to be honest.
Yeah, and I guess you'll always have that bond. Johnny, I have to ask you about Jack Charlton. You almost ended up playing for the Republic of Ireland that summer. Tell us that story, please.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that was obviously a great experience for me personally. But so Jack, I think, had been at, I think, our semi-final against St. James's Gate. As I said, I had spent a lot of the season injured, so I hadn't played an awful lot. So when we, after winning the cup, I was probably, as the celebrations were going on, I probably, there was a lot more games in me. I would have felt, I had booked a holiday in America, which I spent a lot of those summers in America around that time, visiting family. And so on my flight to America, the Irish team just happened to be on the same flight, and I got to meet Paddy Bonner. And of course, this is 1991, the year after 1990 in Italia, 1919, all that. So it's a fantastic Irish squad that I looked up to. While I was in Boston the next day, one of the days following, shortly after arriving, I took my sister to the hotel to meet the Irish team, hopefully. And we were in the foyer of the hotel, and Jack Charlton and the squad arrived in from training. And there was a reporter there from the Irish Times. And
Peter Byrne.
He was Peter Byrne, and he introduced me to, he was just chatting to me, and Jack Charlton arrived in, and he called him over. So I suppose I have to credit that. I don't know if it would have happened apart from that, but Jack asked me if I had my boots with me, and I said I did, because I always went on my summer holidays, I would have always brought my boots and done a bit of training. And he invited me to join the squad because Niall Quinn had been out injured. So
I was on the bench for the match against the USA, and I didn't get to play because Ireland were a goal up, actually, and America equalised, and I was warming up at the time, and I was told to sit down after America equalised. So that was the end of that. So whilst it was an unbelievable experience for me, it was a great year for me overall to remember.
Yeah, absolutely. You nearly made your Irish debut that day.
Nearly, so close, but...
Close.
That, yes. It was a fantastic experience. I was probably a little bit overawed with all these fellas that I was watching the year before playing in the World Cup. And when you look at Irish football, I mean, you know, 88 and the Euros and 1990 the World Cup, and God, in all those years, little did I think that I could end up in an Irish squad. I actually travelled to the Euros in 88. I was working in digital in Galway at the time, and took a half day and flew over for the match in Gelsenkirchen against Holland. You know, and little did I know that, and at the time, I was playing with Galway United, I think, at the time, but little did I think that I'd be in the squad a couple of years later.
Great days, great times. Listen, yeah. Many thanks for reminiscing, Peter Carpenter and Johnny Glynn from that Galway United team that won the FAI Cup back in 1991. James, that's about it. Keep well, stay safe, and as I say, keep your distance, and sure, we'll chat to you next week.
Thanks very much, Aidan.
Cheers.